This is exactly right.
Karen, have you heard of Handsome? It's a new podcast from the brilliant comedians Tig Notaro, Fortune Feimster, and Mae Martin.
I have heard of it. People love it. Every week, this handsome trio of hosts takes a question from a famous friend, people like Stephen Colbert, Reese Witherspoon, Jamila Jamil, the Indigo Girls, and then they do their best to answer that question with plenty of hilarious detours along the way.
You're going to love hanging out with Tig, Fortune, and Mae every week, so go check out Handsome wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. Listen to a new episode of Handsome every Tuesday. Hey, Chris Fairbanks here with some show announcements. Coming up very soon on March 23rd, I'll be at the Meyer Theater in Green Bay, Wisconsin. The next day, I'm at the Laughing Tap in Milwaukee. And then I'm at City Winery in Chicago. I'm closing out all these shows with the haunted Renwick Mansion in Davenport, Iowa. Ooh, sounds scary. And then in May, starting on the 10th, I'll be in New York City, the apple that's big, at the Bell House, followed then by Jam and Java in Vienna, Virginia. That's very near D.C. And then I'm closing out these shows with City Winery in Philadelphia. Thank you, and you're welcome.
Are you leaving? Are you on your way back home? Either way, we want to be there. Doesn't matter how much baggage you claim. Give us a time and date, terminal and gate. We want to send you off in style. We want to welcome you back home. Tell us all about it. Were you scared or was it fine?
Mouth horn.
With Karen and Chris. Welcome to Do You Need a Ride? This is Chris Fairbanks.
And this is Karen Kilgariff.
You know, Karen, before we record, sometimes if I haven't left the house in a while, I will go and try and experience something. So I have something to share with you, but I didn't have to try hard today. It's something very exciting happened. I'm very excited to share it with you.
What is it?
I went golfing. I promise this isn't a golfing story. But I hit, there's one hole there that's real short. It's a 3-par hole. And before it, there's a couple mounds of grass, so you can't really see the flag. And I saw a tiny coyote, like, it looked like an actual puppy, and it was like pouncing playfully. It's before coyotes get mange and they get upset, and then they really don't want to be around people. But he was very a frisky coyote. And I hit the ball. I could not see the ball. It went behind these mounds. But I saw exactly the direction it went. It went to the left of the green, and I knew I probably didn't land on it again. And I ran up I saw the little coyote run off after I hit. I thought, oh no, I wonder if I got close to him. He got scared. And I went, as I walked up, my ball was right by the hole. Karen, ooh. I know this coyote picked up my ball. He understood the rules of golf, and he had it in his little mouth, and he dropped it near the hole. And I don't know if rules-wise, if that is a playable ball. I think so. I think it's the same as if it bounced off a tree and went near the hole. I swear I did not see him do it. I wish I did, but I'm very certain, I'm 90% certain this cute little coyote puppy had my ball in his mouth.
What if you actually got, listen to my theory, because there's another way to look at this. What if you got a hole in one and that coyote took the ball out of the hole?
See, later on in life.
And put it next to the hole.
When they get older, I can tell they are not fans of golf. And we are just there, like, and they don't even respect us. They will hang out on purpose and act like they're bathing. Because we know those coyotes, they don't really, they're not worried about looking sharp. They're not a fox.
But you're saying a young coyote is going to help you before it gets cynical, before
right.
It learns the ways of the
before
world.
Before he listens to the pack, exactly. This baby coyote was still had this hopeful, I just love it. And I, of course, went online, and there's a lot of footage of little coyotes. They're always young, playing with golf balls in the dark. And some, I'm so excited by it. I just wish I could have seen it.
That was like your own little Legend of Bagger Vance coyote version.
Yeah. What if it gave me life advice right when I came up, like a wise
caddy? Invest in land right as you walk up to the ball. Well, congratulations.
I think they are in order. Congratulations.
I think they are due.
And I did par that hole. If that's a good ending, I think it's as good as it
Those
can
Those words are meaningless to me. I don't know.
It is the goal of golf.
Get it in three? You got it in two.
Yeah, I got it in three. If it was a birdie, boy, that would... Oh, my God, what if a bird swept down and grabbed my ball?
And then went, birdie! That what if they're all so used to you guys golfing at that golf course that they all know how to help you numbers-wise?
Yeah, I would love it if there's a parrot somewhere that yells four. Four! That, of course, is when a ball's heading towards you. A helpful parrot. You know me, I got an animal fever. I just lately...
Since the big bite.
Oh, since that dog bit me, my friend. I almost got bit yesterday. I hugged my friend and he just got a new dog and the dog did not like that I hugged him. And he had a classic Spuds McKenzie Bud Light face. And he lunged at me, but he just nipped at my sweatshirt. And I'm like, hey, Greg, cool, new dog? But it didn't happen. It was just a close call. But it made my day. And it can only be made better by our guest today. God,
there it is.
Segue. I'm so good at it.
That was the segue on par with your coyote experience.
Thank you.
Same.
Today's guest you know from clubs and colleges across the country.
Yeah.
He's a damn delight. He's always been supportive and sweet. And everyone, put your ears together for our friend, Kurt Bronhoeller.
Woo!
Hello!
How are you, buddy?
Hello!
I am so excited to laugh. I heard when you said, went golfing.
That was enough?
it got me going.
Ridiculous!
What are you, 80? Oh, there's more to this story.
You said went golfing, but because of the Zoom digital stuff, I heard wank offing. And I immediately was like, he says wank offing and not wanking off? I went off on that and then came back to be like, there's a coyote involved? And then I was like, it's a golfing story. Okay. But it was a cool 3 seconds. Do you know how your brain can go to like 50,000 dimensions within the space of you taking a breath? That's what happened.
Right.
I like the idea that Chris would start this podcast telling me about a time he went wank offing. I'd just be like, excuse me, no thank you. That's private.
I'm just thinking of a kid that his parents immigrate here and he's new to a school. And he wants to relate to the other kids. They're all coming of that age. And he says, do you guys like wank offing? And they're like, you're going to like it here, kid.
The new Australian guy's weird. Yeah.
That's probably how they do say it in Australia.
Yeah.
Wank offing? Kurt, what's going on? What do you have
to
report?
What the hell is going on, Kurt?
What par are you shooting these days?
Yeah.
What's up?
Oh. How's your wank-off game?
I really hope that coyote put that... I want him to have helped you so badly now. Also, I love that you were searching a very specific search when you found many videos of baby coyotes playing with golf balls.
Yeah, it's common because I see them and we've just gotten used to, sure, there's rattlesnakes also, which, we avoid those. But the coyotes do not want to be our friend, and I want them to be because a lot of them are really dog-like and cute. Not that they have to be cute for me to like them. Animals.
No. I once found a coyote who was just asleep on the side of the road in Griffith Park. And so I called and I was like, something's wrong. And so I called animal control. At first I called 911 and they're like, stop. And then
what's your emergency? Well, it's more of a concern.
I've got a sleeping coyote where I am. And
I think he's having nightmares.
And so I waited. So then I got in touch with the animal control. They're like, we'll send a park ranger, whatever we send. And then while I'm waiting, he just like wakes up, stands up and trots off. And then as he trots into the woods, like the animal control pulls up and I'm standing there. And he's like, did you call? And I was like, he just walked away. He's like, yeah, of course he did. And then he just drove away.
Oh, wow. He couldn't be bothered.
What if that is like a pranking coyote and yes. he's just trying to mess with that animal control guy because he's the enemy?
Yeah, that's one thing we've learned, I think, is they love pranking humans.
Yeah.
Why was that guy upset? Usually he has to scrape up roadkill with a shovel. He should have been delighted.
Yeah, problem took care of itself, pal.
That's the first thing I thought of when you said I saw a coyote sleeping next to the side of the road. I'm like, oh, no, that's just what Lauren told you. That coyote was dead. It sounded like someone was really trying to keep you from the harsh realities of Griffith Park.
They nap all the time. Usually it's on a nearby ranch, Kurt. They go off to a ranch to nap.
A nap ranch. I mean, I know about it.
Look, I've dealt with it.
On Bananas, has there been any weird, what's your favorite animal-related Bananas story?
I mean, there's so many animals. We want to make t-shirts that say birds, buttholes, bananas, because it's mostly birds and butthole stories. What's my favorite? Oh, one of my favorite animal stories is there was a crow in Oregon. It showed up at a elementary school and came in through a window into a science class and then was just like jumping from kids' desk to kids' desk. They put a little hat on it and it was totally okay with it. There's like a photograph of it wearing a tiny hat and it was talking and it was saying words and it was cursing a lot. And so, because a lot of people don't know that crows can talk, but crows are hyper smart and a lot of them can talk if they're humanized or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And
trained.
Which all you have to do that is put a hat on them.
It's called humanized, Karen.
Okay. I mean, yes.
Once you put a hat,
yes, and.
Once you put a hat on it, it's humanized. Okay. It's not trained.
Bzz, it makes a bzz sound and then it's humanized.
And the story behind it. So all these kids were like fascinated and, you know, the teacher was fascinated. They had to call, they called a bunch of people and like animal control wouldn't come. And then wildlife rescue started to come. But then a kid who was not in that class recognized the crow and was like, that's my neighbor's crow friend, like not her crow. So what had happened, this was the craziest story, is that this woman who lived like 20 miles away, she fed this crow every day. So it wasn't like her pet or anything. It was a wild crow, but she would feed it and talk to it. And it could talk and it was very smart and everything, but it really annoyed her neighbor. So when she went out of town for the weekend, her neighbor kidnapped the fucking bird and drove it like 50 miles away and let it off somewhere because it didn't want the woman said the bird would go after the neighbor a lot because the bird saw the neighbor as like a threat to her friend.
Yeah, they do that. Crows will shit on you if they don't like the cut of your jib.
Dive bomb you. Yeah. And then the bird slowly made its way back towards the area, but didn't know where his friend was. And he was lost, but he found a Planet Fitness and he stood. This is so crazy. He stood on top of the Planet Fitness, the door, and just talked to everyone who was going in and out of the Planet Fitness until he saw a friend of the woman who was coming out and then taking her son to school, followed that woman's car and then followed the boy who was the son of the friend of the woman who knew the crow. And then the woman came and picked up the crow and brought it home.
Holy shit.
Oh, my Lord.
That's incredible.
Wasn't that crazy?
I like that, and correct me if I'm wrong, this whole crow story doesn't involve him flying at any point. It's mostly vehicular travel and hat wearing.
And crow napping. Tons of crow napping.
Tons.
I want him to have gotten on top of the Planet Fitness to have used a ladder.
And then a helicopter picked him up and drove him back to his old neighborhood. There's women on TikTok, or there's a woman, I should say, on TikTok who did a thing where she was feeding crows and they kept more and more kept coming into the tree in her front yard, bringing her presents, which is my favorite when they bring little shiny things. Yep. Like, here, you like this? It's a bottle cap, which is the cutest. But then she was like, as she walks, they follow her up the street. So it, like, if you were, I would just imagine like a 14-year-old goth doing this, oh, and then you have like an army of crows walking behind you.
Pretty awesome.
Like, it would be a dream come true.
Oh, yeah.
For me.
And they can communicate to other crows what you look like. So you could go into a new neighborhood and the new crows would come flocking to you.
That, okay.
They'd be like, she's great.
She's
You'll
cool.
get really good corn. Or whatever. Crow phone.
Oh my God. How do they do that? How is that proven? How do they communicate with each other until they do they describe what you're wearing?
There was another story where it was like they showed, like, they had one group of crows where like a guy would harass them all the time, and then another one where another guy would like give them treats all the time. And then they like went to a separate, I don't know, murder of crows that was nearby, and that murder had communicated what the guy looked like who harassed them, so that mm-hmm. they started harassing the guy who harassed the other murder of crows. It was crazy. It's straight up crazy. I don't know how they do it. I mean, they can talk.
You know how they do it? Gossip.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
They
get little kitchen tables and they sit around and they talk massive shit.
Oh God, I hope it was a top hat.
It was a little Santa's hat. That's what, because it was around Christmas time.
And what bold child. The idea of doing that, putting a hat on a crow, actually, that kid had.
The crow was sitting on their desks and just being like, eat my ass. Because it was cursing a lot.
Is that really what it was saying?
I don't know if it was saying eat my ass. It was cursing. It was cursing. I know that because the woman who picked him up was like, well, he does curse a lot. He does have a foul mouth. And if anyone doubts a single word I just said, the article is in the Oregonian. I remember it. You can Google Planet Fitness Crow and the Oregonian.
It's a legit newspaper.
I never even thought about that part.
It really is.
Oh, is it?
I thought you were going to say I thought you were going to say, if you want to do it, you can Google News of the Coast or whatever, where it's like, good.
Yeah.
Yep. But it's really the most legit newspaper of the Pacific Northwest.
I could talk animal stories from bananas for forever, really.
I mean, it is what I asked of you.
And that is the joy of that podcast. Me, it's just kind of like weird news. You go, oh yeah, I love that. I love the idea of it. It's delightful. You kind of can hear what's going on in the world, but it's not all the stuff that makes you want to have a heart attack. But there's so much of it that there's now, at this point, you guys have been doing it for
Maybe three years.
But now it's like all these subcategories. It's like this again. Oh, one of these. Like there's so many subcategories of weird news. It's amazing.
Yeah. And this is The Last of Us, which is all about like their zombies are like fungus instead of being what it's a virus. And I was immediately like, yeah, I know. Because there was one we did about bees. Which was, there's like a fungus that infects bees. It kills them, then takes over their brain and makes them have sex with as many other bees as they possibly can until their bodies disintegrate just to pass the fungus on to other bees. And so there's zombie bees that are just fucking constantly. It's crazy. So like that whole Last of Us thing is totally from like, you know, from bees.
Yes. From science.
From science.
Well, Kurt, can you tell us your best butthole story?
My best butt. Well, that's a pretty good butthole story because the fungus actually becomes their butthole. But
kind of sounds like you're lying a little bit. Just, you know what I mean? Like that sounded like a fifth grade lie where you're just like going with what Chris said.
You had me until fungus butthole.
Funny you should mention that because that's out. Exactly.
I swear to God, that's part of it. The bottom half of the bee becomes the fungus. And so that's where it is. It just, the whole bee is fungus at that point. And it's, you know, shoving it into places.
Wow.
But I'm trying to think the best butthole story.
Butthole.
Ooh, it's a good one. I mean, like we used to have, when we first did the original, like the thing that, the pilot that this was based on, we did a whole segment called What's Up Your Butt? And it was just x-ray scans from emergency rooms of things that had been removed from people's butts. And we've seen a lot of those. But still, the most surprising one is a full Buzz Lightyear action figure, which I'm still confused as to how, because it has arms that go out like this. You can understand the dome part, but then the arms are sticking up like this. You know, because he's saying to infinity and beyond. So that was, the joke was to infinity and be ouch. So that's probably one of my favorite butthole ones.
Oh, God, I love it. When you did that segment, did you play Eddie Murphy's song, Put a Little Man in Your Butt? Do you guys remember that song?
Put a dinner in your butt.
Put a tiny tree in your butt. It's, my sister and I had the list memorized. We lived in a small town. There wasn't a lot to do.
Yeah.
And list of things that you could, according to Eddie Murphy, put in your butt for fun.
Put a tiny man in your butt. Put a whole rubber band in your butt.
Yes.
And it's it was very catchy. It was very well written.
Yeah. Yeah. God, just lock him in a room with coked up. Who did all that music with him? He spent like the weekend with Rick James, I think.
Oh, really?
And made all those songs.
Yeah. I don't think
for Party All the Time and all that. Mm-hmm.
What were your favorite as kids? Like, what were your favorite comedy albums that happened to listen to?
Man.
Delirious I listened to, and that's right when Walkmans came out. Mm-hmm. So I have a very distinct memory of being on, like, the volleyball bus, and my friend Patty Leone snapped off one of the, like, you, on your Walkman, you could snap off a speaker and give it to somebody else. And like then reattach it later. Well, you weren't breaking anything.
Oh,
and
right.
So we just held, she had hers on and then I held the thing up and we listened to that thing because we were a tiny high school. So we'd have to go play other tiny high schools. So we'd have to drive like up the, you know, California coast up into like Point Arena and up by Eureka and like so far away just to find another school that was also tiny and bad at sports. And so, you know, we'd like listen to the whole thing both sides a couple times, like there and back or whatever. So it was groundbreaking because I felt like all the comedy I'd seen up till that point was like Evening at the Improv, kind of mild. Everyone had a blazer on. It was very like, you can tell this joke at work or whatever. And it just felt so different. And it was just so genuinely hilarious. I just loved it.
I remember watching that, I guess on cable when like over and over and over and Raw, Delirious and Raw, over and over and over and over. Oh, man, I was obsessed with both of those.
Yeah, he's so good.
I'm almost embarrassed that my first comedy album that I listened to was Andrew Dice Clay. Because he was on Def Jam, Def American. And so maybe that's how I found out about it. There was older kids in my neighborhood that were listening to it. But it was the same thing you're saying, Karen. It was like, if you're used to the Blazer comedy of late night MTV half hour comedy hour with Mario Joyner. It's insane that someone's talking about squirting shampoo on the floor because he loves Pert. I don't actually, a lot of the stuff, I bet if I listened to it now, none of it would hit me the same way, but that it just happened to be the first.
You don't think dirty nursery rhymes would hold
up? You know what? I never was into the. I'm like, this seems a little juvenile, and I was 15. But yeah, some of the stories, like him getting very angry about expensive shampoos, so he would take the pert. Shoot it all over the floor like someone's load. I take the jaboba. So it was like about him stealing shampoo, actually. And I just thought, how hilarious to focus on that and tell it to a crowd of people. But yeah, I didn't like the rhyming. I've never liked rhyming.
I think the only actual tape I had, though, was Adam Sandler's. Do you remember that? Did anyone listen to that?
Yeah, you might be right.
It was all sketches. It was mostly sketches and songs, so it wasn't stand-up or anything. And it was the first time I heard sketch comedy, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, the goat in the back of the truck. There was a goat. He did all the voices. There was other people in it. I remembered.
Yeah, I remember one where like he bought a bag of weed from a guy, but it was pencil shavings. And that's all I remember. Like, that is the extent to that I remember. I would listen to it over and over and over again. And I remember one word, like four words from one sketch.
It's so funny that at that time, though, I don't think I did not realize comedy albums were a thing. I just didn't, you didn't know that. Yeah.
I remember watching that whole like Live at the Improv stuff. And I don't know, and I still want, and maybe you guys have heard this joke and know what comedian this was, but I remember I was probably 13. I saw this on like some variety show. It was a dude, white dude in a blazer. And he said, I was at the airport and I went to go to use the bathroom, but they had a sign up that said, please use floor below. And they didn't even put down paper or anything.
But I would laugh at that, I'm afraid. If someone said it tomorrow, even having you heard you say it just now, be like, I love that Steve Middleman bit.
For real, I wanted so bad to be like Gary Mulder, dear. I just immediately know the comic by the most obscure airport joke possible.
I know, I was actually getting excited there. I'm like, I bet I know who it is. Damn, I don't.
I have one that maybe you guys can identify that's one of my favorite, or I shouldn't say my favorite. It's almost like the first stuff I saw I loved. I loved it all. I loved that people were doing it. There didn't seem to be any... It was like they're making it up right now, that idea where like everything about it seems so magical. But there was a guy that did this joke where he's at the grocery store and he says he has all of his groceries and the last thing he has on the conveyor belt is a package of toilet paper. And then when he gets up to when the woman's checking him out, he says to her, so for all of this, how much of, like, he's holding up the toilet paper, how much of this do I need for this? Is this enough? This, and he just keeps doing it. You know who that guy is?
No.
He was blonde. He was kind of just like a regular guy looking. But I think about that joke all the time where I'm like, that's the, you know, when you're trying to write comedy and you can't think of anything, and then you just start thinking of, well, like, that's so easy. It's simple. Everyone can relate to it. And then you're just sort of like, why can't I think of it? Like, like, where's my conveyor belt toilet paper?
Yeah.
joke.
And little did you know you would have dozens of them by the time you were 30.
It's my true inspiration.
It seems crazy to me, but the one comic that I saw on one of those shows late at night that I related to was Jay Moore, because he had on a leather jacket and a Bad Brains t-shirt. And I was like, there's a comedian that listens to Bad Brains?
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, he actually did. He produced some documentary about Bad Brains just recently, I noticed, but I don't.
But he was also a great stand-up. He had great jokes, did amazing impressions. Like, he was great.
Yeah, but it's crazy to me that I saw a version of him with, like, long surfer hair and a Bad Brains t-shirt and a leather jacket. Like, he was trying that look out. And he was also young. He was, like, one of the youngest comics I had ever seen on one of those shows. Like... So thank you, Jay Moore, for being my inspiration into getting into comedy.
The week I started comedy, like the I had wanted to do it, and I was hanging out at this one like it wasn't really an open mic night. It was kind of booked, but there was like a bunch. It was like 12 comics, a showcase night, I guess. But and I hung out there for like almost over a month before I could get up the guts to do it. And then when I finally did it, I'm like, it's so original. Like, I was convinced I was the only person like me to be doing stand-up comedy and the way I was doing it. And a week later, I saw Janine Garofalo on Half Hour Comedy Hour, and I just stood up and started crying and walked out of the room. And all my friends were like, oh, Karen, poor kid. And it was like, I was like, there's no reason for me to be doing stand-up comedy anymore if she's doing it. Like, she had black tights and cut-off jeans over her black tights and combat boots and, like, you know, a cool shirt or whatever and cool everything. Yeah. Like, that's what I wanted to be like. And then she was doing her amazing jokes, like when she's saying to the waiter, like tapping her wrist, like, what time is it? And he's like, yes, what is it? And she's like, what bone is this? Like, he's, what else would she be asking? But what time is it? And he's like, can I help you? Yes, what bone is this? Like, stuff like that. And then I was just like, oh, forget it. I shouldn't be doing this. Literally started crying. And my friends made fun of me so hard because it was just like, you know.
How old were you?
I thought I was 20.
Oh, that's crushing.
It was terrible.
Yeah. Especially at 20. I can't believe you tried it at 20. I didn't try stand-up until I was 29. I was very old. Yeah. Oh, quote unquote. You can start anytime.
Right.
Yes, you can. I had just flunked out of college, so it was almost like it was my last gasp of doing anything at all before I was like, okay, I'll just be a gutter drunk and never do anything else with my life. So it was kind of like I had to really paint myself into a corner. So it wasn't like a cool plan. Like, I had all this great, you know, I was doing great stuff and I was working up to it or whatever. It was like, well, if I'm not in college, maybe my parents will like it if I do stand-up comedy. Just like, no, that's not a solution.
Yeah, what were your parents like when you said you wanted to be a comic, Kurt? Were they supportive?
I'm still not sure if my dad knows. I think he knows. I'm sure he knows. Maybe. And I think my mom was just so, she was so supportive without ever understanding anything that I did. Do you know what I mean? That it just was like slotted in with everything else, you know. At least you're not wearing a phone cord as a belt anymore. Like, that's, I'm sure, what she was thinking. Like, that's fine. Okay.
Did you just rip it off an old phone one day? Like, was that your punk rock era?
It sure was. It sure was. Yeah. It would be a classic outfit. Would be a phone cord, and it was a curly Q phone cord around my waist, just tied, with a ripped ween shirt and purple hair,
and that was a krill on your shoulder.
Yeah, and yep, that was. And honestly, she missed most of the worst haircuts because I was at college when I did them. At one point, I had a completely shaved head with just I left the front, just this like little a coxcomb of hair in the front that I would then sculpt into two horns with pomade, like an ant. Sniffing out his place to go.
Wow, the visual.
Uh-huh.
Wait, I saw Annalise put together a very nice bio of you, which is always funny when it's someone that you already know, and then you're like, oh yeah, I would like to know where he went to college. Finally, the information I've wanted. But you went to Johns Hopkins. Were you pre-med or was that a medical situation?
No, that's what I wondered.
It was not. I was not pre-med. I was philosophy. And so, you know, the classic place you go for an English philosophy degree, Johns Hopkins University. I like to be in a minority wherever I go of what other people are doing.
Yeah.
There was like four other people that were also doing that, and we all lived together. But we were definitely like not. The campus was very pre-med.
Yeah.
And there was a big building on campus that Bloomberg had paid for, Mike Bloomberg. And it was just like, we are making weapons.
Whoa.
So, yeah. So I think now it's a lot different. Like, there's a theater department now, I think, at Johns Hopkins. But when I was there, it was just like all the plays, we were just putting them on by ourselves.
And what, why was that your, I imagine you got good grades, so you had a choice if you got into Johns Hopkins.
I think I only got into two places. I got into Johns Hopkins and Middlebury, and I decided to go to Johns Hopkins. Yeah, my dad had gone there, and that was what he was going to help me if I went there. So I was like, oh, okay, yes, I will.
I'll go there and do the thing you don't want me to do. It'll be perfect.
Yeah, it'll be great. I can study useless things anywhere.
Pay for it.
Yeah, everything that I wanted to do in college, they started those programs like the year I graduated. They all of a sudden there's a new building and they're like, oh yeah, we teach pre-film animation,
yeah,
graphic design, everything I wanted to do. Prior to that, they're like, you can either teach art history or become a studio painter and try and do shows, gallery shows. And I'm like, I want to draw things and get them in magazines. And they're like, yeah, we don't know anything about that. And then all...
we cannot help you.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh, I should have taken a break and then come back. Because, yeah, now there's like a full-on... People put out animated films there. Just...
It's amazing to think of like if I had started making things at a younger age. Because I left school and then just started improvising. I was just improvising from like 22 to 29. Yeah, and not making a goddamn thing. I just wish I was making things earlier. You know, I had convinced myself that improv was it was just like jazz, man, is the only art form that exists that is just created on the spot and it doesn't have a record. You know, like I thought it was like so noble that I had nothing to show for 7 years of work.
Yeah, it is.
Because it was the 90s, right? Or 2000s?
Yeah, early 2000s, yeah.
Early 2000s. I think that is what... It was like pre-internet mentality. And I came up in the midst of it where it's like, no matter what you did, you were a sellout. Unless you basically, you know, did exactly that. Like, did a thing that wasn't recorded, did a thing that wasn't rehearsed, did a thing that wasn't... nobody was paying you. Like, that was the only way to get... invisible cred.
Yeah.
And then social media came along and it's like, nope, we're all going to make some money and we're all going to be nice to each other. Get used to it. It's a 180, everybody.
It's a real 180. It took me so long to not see telling people that I was performing as bragging. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It took me so long to see self-promotion as not like being braggy about it. I was just like, it was like year, like 10 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, I still struggle with that and it's so bad. I can't post another stand-up clip. People are going to think I'm riddled with confidence.
Here's what I think is interesting though. After all this time... My biggest regret, because it took me a really long time to ever take an improv class, that turned out to be my biggest fear because I have a lot of control issues and I like to see things exactly how I see it. And then basically that's it. So stand-up comedy is perfect, right? Because, and then you're getting like applause for that. Like, this is only my idea. It's only me. And so improv is like the opposite of that. And I was just like, I can't do it. Like, there's no way. And my friend tricked me into doing an improv class with her because she's like, just come with me. You can audit. And I'm like, oh, well, all right. I don't have anything else to do. So I went and the teacher's immediately like, no, no auditing. Get up here. And I was like, this is like, but I couldn't say that because it seemed so unreasonable and kind of crazy where I'm like, this is my version of like, jumping off a cliff or something. Like, I can't do this. This is horrifying to me. And the first scene that I was ever in, I just went to one side of the stage and started flipping burgers with like as if I was dying, just kind of like, ugh. And the guy walked in and I just slowly turned my back so that, and he's like, stop. Chris Barnes, amazing improv teacher. He was like, Karen, stop. Why won't you acknowledge the person in your, if you made it so that it's a hamburger stand, why won't you talk to the customer? I'm like, I don't know. I just don't want to. Like, it was all my instincts were perfectly incorrect. And it really was hard. And then once I started doing it, I was like, oh shit, this is like how you're supposed to be in the world. Like, yes anding reality and like being in it with other people and seeing what they bring and reacting, not planning ahead and not like, you know, controlling everything, but just going with what's happening, which is so much harder than it sounds for some people.
In life, yeah, up to that point, even in life, you were no-butting.
I no-butted the fuck out of things. That was my way.
And also, stand-up is a no-butt at all, almost all, the whole time. And I found it because I started doing stand-up after doing 7 years of improv, and I was teaching improv, you know, it was like my whole life. I struggled so much. It was like stand-up was such a different brain that I was just like, I'm a very good improviser. This is going to be easy. And get up there. And my first 5 minutes was too, like, you know, dead, like not a single joke worked. And I was like, this is a lot of material to not work.
Yeah.
In a row.
None of it. And I was like, I had to like rebuild my brain for it. And once I had rebuilt my brain, I stopped doing improv.
Yeah. I, for a long time when I moved to Austin, because I moved there because of the big stinking improv festival. I don't know if either of you heard of that.
I remember it.
Just a couple years. But that's my group went there, and that's when I got introduced to stand up. And so when I moved there, I was like, oh, I can do both. Because they would have like improv at 8 and then 9 o'clock, there's stand up and I'd be on both shows. And I did that for a while, but I realized there was nights I was able to do stand up and absolutely could not do improv, and then vice versa. It's just obviously a different part of your brain. If you're feeling loose and playful, you would think that would be helpful for stand-up too, but I never did well at both in the same night, ever.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. It would always alternate. Yeah, it is very...
I've also seen some improvisers do stand-up and eat it when on paper what they were saying was funny, but what I realized, like there's a couple of people I've watched and I'm like, oh, they're doing... It's not them doing stand-up, they're doing the character of a stand-up comedian.
Right.
Is what I think,
yes.
As an audience member, that's what I was feeling like the audience was interpreting. Whereas if everybody other person is getting up, even if they're eating it, they're being themselves eating it. And that's the audience can feel. It's like that invisible credit you're getting for just even standing there and saying your real thoughts.
Right.
As opposed to kind of doing a voice or being present, where immediately the audience is like, you're not actually doing it. So we're not going to like laugh at this. It's an interesting... I don't know. I think I find those two things fascinating. And I really do, having been in the 90s, like improv phobic, I became such a believer after that. Whereas like that one class kind of just snapped me out of it, where it's like, you have to be open to things to think things are funny and to be funny in the moment.
Yeah, that divide, that's what I experienced in Austin. People were like, you have to choose one or the other. You can't do both. And I'm like, why not? And then, so it was pressure from other stand-ups where it's like, you can't.
Austin's got rules, Chris.
Yeah, they did rules. And they were at a lot. There was two camps and you couldn't be in both.
Yeah.
It's very strange. It's obviously not that way anymore.
I also find when people come from improv to start doing stand-up, there's an obsession with the form of stand-up. And so all of their first jokes, or I see it a lot at least, are making fun of the tropes of stand-up, or the like holding the mic or adjusting the mic, like that bit I've seen so many times from people like starting off, or like the idea of like, ladies, am I right? You know, and like doing the things that are like the callback to the audience. It's like people being like, these are all the things I noticed about stand-up, but when you do them, the audience is like, yeah, it doesn't. We want to see like you.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of when you do a True. I mean, I'm thinking of a very specific night. It was at Little Joy, and I think, Chris, you were probably on the show. And everyone was having very different sets. So I was like, what is going on with this audience? Because it was like one person would get up that you know was hilarious and it would just be dead silent. And then another person would get up and they would be fine, but they would be killing. And I'm like, oh, are those all your friends? What is it? And I was like getting very analytical about like, what is this? And how do we do this or whatever? And then one person got up that was basically introduced by saying that they do improv or something. And that's what it was like he was up there to go, this is what stand-up is, but almost sarcastically.
Right.
And the audience might as well have all like crossed their arms at the same time. It was so funny and interesting in that way where it's like, oh, you're going to do this 5 more times and then you're going to actually just be doing it instead of doing the voice.
Yeah.
You don't have to have that like thing up.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's like it's an attempt to have like a critical eye making fun of the stand up, but you're doing stand up.
You're doing it. You're in it, buddy.
So the audience feels the inherent dishonesty there, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it's probably a product of the fact that Little Joy usually was just comics other stand-ups waiting to go out.
True.
Every time. And which is, I mean, that place is a block from my house. And lately I've been going there to, if golf isn't boring enough, I've really gotten into playing pool. And there's like a league night down there. And now it's a shame. They're close.
You just go play game to game.
My bingo is down on the corner.
I have a stick that's in my Amazon cart right now. I haven't pulled the trigger on it because they've closed for a month. They're renovating, and they're actually, Little Joy's taking that performance space out. And guess what they're putting in there? The pool table. So this is going to be really bad for my career.
Oh, shit.
But not my future on ESPN.
Trick shot Fairbanks.
World snooker competition.
How does he always know where to leave the cue ball? Oh, there's a coyote on the table.
You and your coyote.
Yeah, it's
tricks.
A shame. I didn't realize I would miss that space. I was so embarrassed when I would go there. Because Monday night is a night for playing pool, and Anna Saragina and all those people that run a show right now, Megan Keister, they all would come out after a show. And I'm like, oh, yeah, they're doing stand-up, which is the thing I'm supposed to do for a living. And I'm just...
Get to work!
Yeah. I try and hide my black fingerless glove that I require.
That makes me sad that room is going away. I think that room was so cool.
It's kind of been hitting me the last couple of weeks of them being closed. Also, the fact that I've been healthy and sober and waking up early because of my unhealthy billiards lifestyle is on hold.
Really makes you think.
Yeah, it is. No one gets on ESPN bowling or playing pool without some damage to their liver.
Without a divorce.
Yeah, or that's without someone leaving you.
Kurt, do you guys, two questions, mm-hmm. two-parter.
I'm ready.
Do you still do Hot Tub, the legendary comedy show?
Yes, we do. We've started up again, and it's Wednesday nights at Permanent mm-hmm. Records Roadhouse.
Oh, yes.
And you, my favorite.
And you guys both have to come and do it anytime you want to get up.
Please.
It's awesome. It's outside. So, you know, COVID friendly, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a cool space because as soon as like the show ends, there's a band that's inside. So literally as you're leaving, you're like, here's just a great local band that I've never heard of. And I just always like hang out and watch a couple songs. And it feels very cool.
Yep. Last time I performed there, went in, saw Frankie and the Witch Fingers, rocked out and bought a T-shirt.
Nice.
I have a teacher. I have nothing to show for my set that night, but I do have my first on purpose tie-dye shirt.
It's the coolest. It's one of the coolest venues in LA right now.
Yeah,
I feel
I think
like
so too.
It really is.
I'm doing it this week. I'm very excited.
It also looks like a dive bar from the 90s, like the checkered floor, red vinyl booths, Budweiser, Tiffany lamps. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, like, the first time I walked in, it was like, my heart, like, this is a real blast from the past, but they're not being, like, kitschy or anything. It's just like, no, this is what a cool bar, this is what it feels like, this is what it looks like.
Yes.
And then that perfect stage at the end. It's, I love that place.
The last, the when you said the checkered floor is a big thing. And I remember the very first time I ever encountered that was at this bar that no longer exists in Baltimore, Maryland, in a section of Baltimore called Pigtown. And only Baltimore would have a section of town called Pigtown because it was where the slaughterhouses were. But then human beings lived there. And mm-hmm. so it was like slaughterhouses and junkyards and salvage yards and then a fucking neighborhood. And Memory Lanes was there. And it was like a 50s-styled punk rock dive bar that would have shows there. And I spent my 21st birthday there, like, getting drunk. Saw so many good shows there in Baltimore. Oh, it was a delight. A delight. If anybody remembers, Memory Lanes and Pigtown.
The best.
They knew that you would think about it later. Memory Lanes.
Remember
us. When did you first start doing things with Kristen Schaal? Was that?
2004. February 22nd, 2004.
Because I bet
the anniversary is coming up.
Living in, I lived with Tig, and that year Tig was on the road for I think a couple months, and Kristen took over her bedroom, and we were like roommates for just a couple months. And I can't remember where she had moved from, but I know she was new to town. That was my second year in LA. So
in LA
for a little while.
Oh, it was New York. This was New York, 2004 New York.
When did she move?
I think she maybe would come out. She would stay in Tig's back house when she came out for like pilot season and stuff like that.
And she had done that a few times, but this time someone, a DJ or someone was living in the back who I think broke in and stole Tig's TV. One of the first things Tig ever bought. And I don't know why I went in her room. Don't tell her. But I peeked in there and there was just a broken window and her brand new TV was gone. And I called her immediately because I love spreading bad news. But
who doesn't?
Kristen stayed in there for a while. We'd have coffee in the kitchen. And I was, we lived together for a short time.
Look at that. Yeah, it's going to be 18 years of us doing the show.
That's amazing.
Very soon.
That's great.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Was Hot Tub just a random? Why'd you name your show Hot Tub?
Because we were trying to come up with a name, and I had been in a hot tub.
Okay,
I'm not kidding. That
would be the story.
That is the actual reason. I had been in a hot tub in like for New Year's, and so we were like trying to come up with a flyer, and I had a photograph of we had like rented a hot tub because we had rented a house in upstate New York, I think to go skiing or something. And then we rented a hot tub because like the company would just come and like inflate a hot tub in the backyard and fill it up. And so when you like arrived, it was like hot and ready to go. It's nice. It's like the fact that I had the wherewithal to do that at 29 blows my mind away, you know? And I have this awesome photograph of all of us in there, but all of our faces are obscured by like the steam, except for my one buddy, Mike, who has this giant beard on and he's so high and he's holding a beer and he's like looking out and it looks like it's from the 70s or something. And so I gave that photograph to a buddy of mine and he just like, you know, just did some graphic design magic. And that was like our first flyer, which was Hot Tub.
Nice.
And it was a Wet Jubilee of Comedy was the name of it originally. And originally when we had Hot Tub, there was an animal race that was happened every show for like the first 6 months of the show. And there was a lot of animals lost in the space.
You would line them up and they would make it to a finish line?
Yes. We would like... Once we did cockroaches, the theater did not like that. We did sand.
I'm on the theater side. Yeah.
We did sandworms once. They're disgusting. We did crickets. The theater really didn't like that.
Yeah, this seems more like bugs.
We were we did snails. Well, the thing is, we had to have animals that you could like keep in a box.
Oh my God.
And so we kind of stopped. We stopped as shortly after, but and then we felt, you know, because we had just started the show, we were like, people are going to be really disappointed. This is, by the way, it would sell out at 40 tickets. And we were like, people are going to be so upset that we've got rid of the animal races at the end of this comedy show. We were like really worried.
There's
it's
a part,
not the reason they're coming.
Yeah.
People would always be like, what is happening? Why is this happening at the end?
People, it's surprising. There's this Brennan's pub near where I lived in Venice, and they had turtle racing, which I did not. It's people yelling and screaming, and the turtles are running in a panic. Like, they are not enjoying it.
Yeah, we realized it was a bad idea.
They do know to go in a straight line, and people get very competitive, and it's just not my scene. Not my scene at all.
I would prefer to play chicken shit bingo.
I prefer to keep going to these underground dog fights I've been betting on.
Chris!
Sorry, but it's just the energy in the room. It can't be duplicated.
The passion. I thought when you said that, I was imagining that you were having like comedians that were on the show bring a pet to race. Like... And maybe it's because when my sister was in kindergarten, this is like the legendary family story. When my sister was in kindergarten, they had a day in kindergarten, so five-year-olds, called Pet Parade. And you just brought your pet, dog, cat, whatever you wanted, to school. And so they could walk it in a circle at Pet Parade in the kindergarten. So my sister brings our cat, Taffy, who was just one of them orange cats that we found in the crick. And... Of course, Taffy spends maybe 20 seconds there, and there's dogs around and other cats, and Taffy flips out. My sister's trying to hold it as a five-year-old, and Taffy scratches her eye directly underneath. So she almost lost an eye, but instead it was just a scar she had till she was like in high school. But it wasn't like it almost looked like a crease, but we talk about it where it's like, who doesn't know that animals don't get along? Like, those animals probably won't get along. And that the people in charge of the animals just got here. They're 5 or 6 years old, six max. And they're in charge of Pet Parade. Like, the most psychotic idea, I think.
I can't even imagine. I wouldn't even let my five-year-old walk our dog current. Like, at all. At all, at all, at all. So that is amazing. That was like every, because there's definitely not, it's not all small dogs. There's just some normally big dogs. They're like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, my sister didn't have the cat on a leash. We don't have that. So it was just her holding the cat and also both my parents worked. No one was with her. I'm sure my carpool dropped her off with the cat and it was like, good luck.
Yeah,
we'll see.
I refuse to believe that day ever went off without a hitch. I do not think there is ever a successful cat day.
What if it was always great until my sister, and then she ruined it for everybody with Taffy?
Well, I hope she believes that. I do have a weird way to marry our conversation about hot tub and the pet parade, is that for a hot tub in, I think... 2011, I did the 9/11 Memorial Puppy Parade.
Oh no!
And it was at the top of the show, and we did exactly that. We walked around the block. I had a marching band, and everyone brought their dogs to the show, and then we marched around the block with a marching band. And I had a big banner that says 9/11. And then we brought everybody back to there. That we just started the show. That was just like how it happened.
Well, this was not, because there was a version of this that you did at Bridgetown, and I actually was in the parade. I marched with people.
Oh, there was a marching band, but it wasn't a 9/11 memorial puppy parade.
It was just a celebration. I think everyone was going to get cookies or donuts or so. Or maybe I'm doing what I've done many times and confused you with Andy Kaufman. He brought us when I was a child to get cookies. Yes.
That's right.
And that at Bridgetown show, there was also a guy on a unicycle dressed as Darth Vader with a bagpipe that shot fire. Do you remember him?
No.
Yeah, like I think we marched past him and he did a performance while we were like marching past, but it was crazy.
Like a steampunk, did he have one of those utility kilts?
Yeah, he had a kilt on.
Yes, he had to.
And he had a Darth Vader mask and a bagpipes that played music, but then also shot fire out the tops.
That had to be a modification. Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't a real bagpipe. That's not from the store. It doesn't come that
way. No, they don't do that at Guitar Center.
But you hired that guy to be someone you passed, or was it by chance?
No. Okay. We hired that guy.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. I don't know if we paid him, but he was definitely part of the entertainment.
You invited him. Yes. That's what matters. Yes, he was invited. Well, I just want to say, because we should have you plug things like your newest special, Perfectly Stupid, that you just released at the end of last year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can watch it for free right now. It's called Perfectly Stupid, and it's on YouTube. And if you don't want to watch it on YouTube on your computer, you can watch it on Amazon for $5.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The New York Times said it was good, so you know somebody likes it. Just one person.
So you know. You know it's anti-trans the entire time. What?
From top
That's not
to bottom.
Right.
I'm very proud of it. I'm very happy with it, how it turned
Congratulations.
Out.
Congratulations. Getting a great review from the New York Times is a big deal. That they don't give those out easy.
I have been trying for 18 years.
And you did it.
And it felt very good. I was like, oh, good. Even though I was paid nothing for this special, am paid in kind words from the New York Times.
Yeah, Kurt, that's exactly was my situation. Pay for it on Amazon or it's free on YouTube. I like to give people that option. but I didn't have a review. I had a review in the Saturday Evening Post. It was a magazine. Norman
Rockwell. Back in 1941?
Illustrated, yeah.
That's nice.
Well, you know how a lot of my jokes are World War II era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
period bits.
Listener, if you haven't watched it, because you also have two other comedy specials. Mm-hmm. One, two.
Two more.
Kurt is truly one of the best stand-up comedians I've ever seen. Aww. You are, honestly, and I don't tell you this enough or directly enough, but when I watch you do comedy, I'm like, that is how it is supposed to be done. It's so smart. It is so truly delightful and beautifully developed and completely accessible. Like, it's smart, not snobby. It's always hilarious and then gets more hilarious. Like, you have blown my mind multiple times when I've watched you live.
Oh, I really, thank you. It's nice to hear that because I'm just writing all new material now and I feel like a real idiot.
It's the worst feeling. I really feel like I spent my entire career, especially since when I finally made a special, a lot of the material there's versions of it on my very first album. Like, it's spanning an embarrassing 20 years. And now I really feel like I have to start over. And that pressure has been sitting here for like 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's still, what I'm saying is, much like the loss of a loved one, it never gets easier.
And it really does. No matter how many times you go through it, you're still like, well, I guess I don't have any more ideas. There always is that feeling and it's like, it's simply not true, but it's very difficult to not feel it.
I mean, it's true that you get fewer and fewer ideas. I mean, that's just how the world works.
It's just how brains work in time.
Yeah.
I'll be 80 years old being like, I gotta have one more.
Delightful to talk to you. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Yeah, you're the best.
Thank you.
You put us both in a good mood. I'm going to speak
I'm in
Karen
a better mood. I am.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. I bet when we log off after this, we're all going to be alone in our place just whistling. That's what people do when they're in a good mood, right?
Yeah.
Or if they're a serial killer, they whistle too. You know what? I've just remembered. I fucking hate whistling.
It's very creepy.
Even if you're good at it, don't do it.
No.
And I'm talking to you, guy from Scorpions.
Wow.
Yeah. I do personal.
That's for a song celebrating the wall coming down, the Berlin Wall coming down.
I know. I'm more of a Hasselhoff guy.
Chris loved the Stasi, and he didn't want that wall coming down. He was for it. He loves it.
Well, watch, Kurt, anywhere you see comedy with a parade after. He's one of the best. And thank you for being on our podcast, Kurt. Thank you for talking about buttholes and animals, too. All the assignments I gave you. You've been listening to Do You Need a Ride? Oh, my God. This voice will never get better. D-Y-N-A-R.
A-R.
A-R.
Yeah, I'm in it, too.
I got caught up in it. This has been an Exactly Right production.
Produced by Annalise Nelson.
Mixed by Edson Choi.
Our talent booker is Patrick Kottner.
Theme song by Karen Kilgariff.
Artwork by Chris Fairbanks. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Dynar Podcast. That's D-Y-N-A-R Podcast.
For more information, go to exactlyrightmedia.com.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Follow Do You Need a Ride on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen so you never miss an episode.
If you like what you hear, rate and review the show.
And visit the exactlyrightstore.com to purchase Do You Need a Ride merch.